It was fun. I mean, you come here, anything goes. You know, Houston's very, you know, you buy the rules here. You know, you're with your aunt and uncle and cousins. You're, you know, Joe would just laptop by medicine. And it was a free for all, right? But it was really, you know, stressful. You know, politically unstable, security issues all over the place. So there was no clear end, you know, end in sight in terms of where Iraq was going to go. Our mandate that was. Iraqis need to rebuild Iraq. And so what we tried to do is find opportunities where we could employ. I mean, Iraq has experienced a unique 40, 50 year span, right? Dating to, you know, the removal of the king into where we have modern day. So it's been a very tumultuous time, and leadership by mimicry. This is what he's doing. This is what I need to do. This is what he's doing. This is what I need to do. It was great. Yeah, it was great. Got me through the first 10 years.
Mahaba and welcome to Tajarab. In this episode, we sit down with Mohammed Lkhlairi, an Iraqi-American venture capitalist and managing partner at Iraq Venture Partners, who brings a unique bicultural perspective to Iraq's evolving startup ecosystem. Through partnerships with the IFC and newly signed agreements like the one with the Orange Corners Innovation Fund, dedicating over $2 million to Iraqi founders, IVP is bridging international capital with local opportunities. As both an international investor and a local ecosystem builder, Mohammed shares invaluable insights about the realities of Iraq's investment landscape, why institutional development matters more than available capital, and how to successfully bridge local and international business practices. From challenging common assumptions about Iraq's business environment to providing practical insights about ecosystem growth, Mohammed draws from his experience managing investments and building cross-border partnerships to explain what it takes to invest successfully in Iraq. Whether you're an international VC looking to enter the market, a regional investor curious about Iraq's potential, or simply interested in understanding Iraq's startup ecosystem, this conversation offers a rare glimpse into the mind of someone who successfully operates in both worlds. Before we leave you with the episode, we want to thank our partners at Key, Iraq's leading financial technologies company, providing innovative services and products to over 11 million users daily. We're also grateful to have the support of our sponsor, Shems Telecom, a pioneering ISP building extensive fiber-to-home infrastructure, connecting thousands of Iraqi users. I'll leave you with this fun and valuable conversation, and I hope you enjoy.
هذا البودكاست برعاية شمس تيليكوم.
So tell me, before we get started, I just want to, I've seen you, I've heard about you. How did you get started? How did this get started?
Yeah, so
interviewee becomes the interviewer. Yeah.
That's easier. So I started my career at the station around 3 years ago.
Okay.
I started as an intern, okay. Right? I was 15. I was a fourth grader, which is, I think it's a 10th grader, ninth grader.
Yeah.
And they had an post about interns. They wanted fresh graduates as interns. Okay. So I said, I just graduated out of ninth grade. I think I qualify.
Yeah.
So I didn't
sign actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that was a short interview.
I don't know. That's okay.
Not to surprise you.
Show you? Okay.
You can do that. Yeah, you can.
I was actually going to go pretty strong. I don't wear jackets.
You don't?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this is a little more casual, yeah.
My working man kind of, yeah. But that's Dyer Hardy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, bravo on you.
Because, I mean, this is wonderful. This is the type of culture, arts, business that Iraq needs. I mean, really, it's the type of topics that you cover are wide, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we do. We have kind of diversified.
Are you the Joe Rogan of of Iraq?
I don't think we'll ever have a Joe Rogan.
Sadly, I don't think the media landscape really facilitates that. You know, someone having that kind of comfort around cameras, right? Yeah. Because there's always red lines. There's always
There are red lines. Yeah. But do you think they're reducing? Their people are speaking a little more openly, a little more freely. I mean,
sure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of getting there, yeah, right? Yeah. You see more things. I think, like, I'm not sure what you consider it. They say the Overton window is expanding slowly, yeah, of things, yeah, you can normally say. And and I think that's partly due to, and thanks to media, right? And it's being so open. And also because everyone's... is grasping media better, yeah, right? So for example, Party A, right, has dominated media for the past, let's say, 10 years, right? But now Party B also has its own army of consultants who can also help it figure out media. So when Party A has this talking point and Party B comes up with a colliding talking point, yeah, it kind of opens up the space for people in the middle to say whatever they want.
Exactly. Along the list.
Gives them room, right? So they can be considered with Party. So it's good to a degree. I like that. But yeah, thank you
for coming. Thanks for coming. Thanks for accommodating me in English.
بالعكس.
أنا يعني أحكي عربي بس أريد أعبر الفكرة 100%. ما, you know. So thanks.
بالعكس. Thank you for coming on. And we've had a couple of guests actually in English. Yeah. We've had Christine from BBS before. Yeah, yeah. It was in English. Yeah. We've had Rawaz in English. Rawaz, yeah. Yeah. It was really nice. Yeah, with Rawaz. I enjoyed it. And we've had the woman that's doing the solar.
Kask. Basima. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Basima.
Yeah. Oh, she's great.
Amazing episode. Brilliant episode. Good. So it's totally normal. And how long have you been in Baghdad?
2 days now. This is my second day. So just here on a quick trip. I'm actually on my fifth day of the trip from the US. So I was living in Dubai for about a dozen years, 12 years. Just moved the family back there. But come out to the region maybe every 2 months. Spend time in Dubai, Baghdad, Basra, Erbil, kind of do the rounds, you know, checking in on everybody.
Yeah, I see. And you've been living in Dubai for
almost 12 years. So I was living there for 12 years, and it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I saw the major transformation in Dubai. But I think for us, it was a personal decision, family decision, being closer to my parents, my siblings, you know, we have young kids and we wanted to kind of raise them closer to family.
So. And the rationale about being in Dubai is like you're kind of in the middle, right? You're not not in Iraq, but you're
East meets West, right?
Yeah.
So, Dubai really does fit that in a lot of ways. And it's really become kind of a regional hub for a lot of countries in the region, right? For business. So they've done a really good job of attracting business and now keeping people there. So
Very direct question, yeah. But so why not Iraq?
Yeah.
Right? Like I know kind of the reasoning behind it, but yeah, also at the same time, like you see these families, yeah, or these individuals who have created, let's say, their own, let's say, ecosystem, yeah, or bubble within Iraq, yeah, whether they're living in an apartment complex or whether it's their own apartment complex.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's kind of this way of living, of going about it, yeah, in Iraq. So
why not Iraq for us? Of course. Yeah, we have considered it. And I think, you know, it's funny you asked that, Jamil, because like I think today the likelihood of living in Iraq probably is the highest it's been in the last 20 years. I mean, the level of living and comfort and the standard of living has really increased significantly here. For me, I left when I was a year old. So I was never really that accustomed to Iraq. And then post 2003, obviously the situation was quite volatile. So for us, Dubai was just a step closer. But I wouldn't rule it out. I'd love, you know, one of the things that I always talk about is, you know, this is a place I want to bring my kids to one day and be able to be proud of, as I used to come here when I was a young kid in the 80s. I'm hopeful that's something I can do and I will do with my kids as they come and start doing tourism and trips and all that good
stuff. Yeah, we'll see. But so you spent a year in Iraq and then moved right away to the US, right?
No, we spent a few years in Vienna, Austria, as kind of a... well, he was not studying there. He studied in Boston, and then you've got the multi-generation here. You know the history even before me. No, so he studied in Boston. The family and then moved back to Iraq and Baghdad and started his first kind of business venture, which was his paint business. And then, you know, in the early 80s, that was when my parents decided to move. The reasons of which, you know, I never get a clear answer. I think there was a lot of challenges going on at the time. There was, you know, the Iraq-Iran war. There was, you know, but they also, I think my dad, having studied in the U.S., saw an opportunity to take us there and you know, give us the education there. So we did that.
But Wait, so you're not particularly sure why you moved to the U.S. from Iraq?
Well, you need to get my dad back on here and find out exactly why. Because, I think it was a combination of different factors in terms of education, opportunity, and the situation here maybe at that time.
I wouldn't have raised my children in the Iran-Iraq war if I had the opportunity.
Yeah, right? So I think it was just a combination of factors. But we moved there, grew up, you know, most of my life in the U.S., you know, grew up there. What they did a really good job of, despite my heavy American accent, was they did a really good job of keeping us connected to the culture. So there we had, you know, an Arabic teacher, you know, an Islam teacher. We would come spend 2-3 months every summer. We were connected to our family. So
did you actually look forward to that?
Well, no, we'd run away from the Arabic teacher every Sunday.
It's kind of the story with every household, isn't it?
Exactly. The tutor on Sunday, but she was sweet. But they did a really, you know, I thought it was great because I felt really connected. And I felt, even though we were raised, you know, there in the U.S. in Houston, Texas, I felt really connected to the culture here. And I was very proud, and it was fun. I mean, you come here, anything goes. You know, Houston's very, you know, you buy the rules here. You know, you're with your aunt and uncle and cousins. You're, you know, Joe will just lap all by medicine. And it was a free-for-all, right? So I think I tried driving a car for the first time at 7 or 8 years old under the bridge. So it was a lot of fun. And, you know, that happened all the way until obviously 1990, 1991, when the Gulf War occurred. And, you know, obviously things changed and the dynamics of Iraq changed quite a bit, you know, during the 90s.
Okay. Yeah, I see. And then, so how did that, so then you grew up there, right? Still being connected to a degree with your Iraqi culture, with your Iraqi roots, etc. Went to UT Austin for your bachelor's in business, right? And then you just went to UT Austin, right?
I did a few graduate programs, executive graduate programs, Singularity, Berkeley.
I remember your dad coming on here and saying, Muhammad still doesn't have an MBA.
Yeah. So, he does give me a hard time for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a stereotype about MBA, so it's not that bad, I think.
Well, I think there's, for us, a big part of the reason. So actually did my GMAT. I was going to be going to, I got accepted to a few universities. I wanted to go to, you know, go to California. I was looking at UCLA, San Diego State, UC River, San Diego. So, I had a bit of a lifestyle in mind, but this was right as our company was really starting to grow. So, you know, we started Kadera Group 21 years ago, 2003-04. And, you know, it really, I got to say there, you know, it wasn't that thing where we had a clear business plan and a strategy in place. It was more of this, let's see what we can do. Iraq's a country of my birth, a heritage country where we, you know, have a lot of family, people that we love. So we didn't have a clear business plan, to be quite honest with you. So I don't necessarily recommend that to a lot of entrepreneurs, but it was kind of what we did. And we just put one step, you know, over the other and slowly grew this business, but we really had to grow it quite organically. I mean, so, you know, HR policies, accounting, and then, you know, understanding which business for. So today we operate essentially 4 business verticals and an investment arm. But it wasn't clear to us at the time where we were going, what we were doing. I did forego that MBA, but I, you know, hopefully can go spend some time in San Diego at some point. Right.
But, so where did you start with the business, right? And how did it come about? And
prior to that, I mean, for my father was doing projects in the U.S. doing real estate development. But, you know, for the better part of...
Why does every family do real estate development?
Well, I think it's just something that they know. It's more, it's in, you know, it's real estate, right? So I think that's something with immigrants that they like to know that, you know, I got in there. This is ours, right? We own it. So we did so he was involved in that, doing, you know, some real estate development, but really not as active as he would have liked. He was trying to do some projects with Iraq, but because of the sanctions, was unable to. So, you know, when the opportunity came about to re-enter Iraq, you know, what I tell people is regardless of your political affiliation or leaning, we felt an opportunity. You know, my father, brother, and I was finishing my undergraduate degree at the University of Texas, doing my finance degree there. Subhay, my older brother, was finishing his MBA at Rice. And we, you know, we felt kind of pulled in some ways. You know, the family has a lot of commercial history dating back to, you know, the 50s and 60s with General Motors and Volvo and the like. And even before that, we felt an opportunity and a, I wouldn't say obligation, but an opportunity to come back here and try to establish something.
This was
2003 and 2004. So we, you know, officially, I think really started in 2004.
How was it, by the way, like witnessing what's happening in 2003? Like, what was it like in your home?
What was it like? It was stressful. I got to say, it was really stressful. I think, you know, at that time, I've got to be on, you know, definitely wasn't adding the same value I am as a board member and a partner today. I think there was a lot of learning. I mean, we were in a desk, maybe, you know, two, three times the size of this working. Okay. There was just a lot of absorption at the time for me. We, you know, I was doing bids and proposals and we were, you know, looking at opportunities.
So, you mean this is when you're in Iraq, right?
I was in between Houston, Amman, and, you know, then was Amman and Baghdad. So we were kind of traveling all over. But I mean, it was early days. It was stressful. I mean, a lot of people, you know, I'm sure many people lived it here, but it was really, you know, stressful, you know, politically unstable, security issues all over the place. So there was no clear end, you know, an end in sight in terms of where Iraq was going to go. And so we started doing general contracting works, construction projects, working for the local municipality, doing some underground water piping systems. So really just being opportunistic.
And right.
You know?
And what were you doing at the time? For example, you're doing the bids, the proposals?
I was mainly working on the bids. So I joined in 2005. I finished my undergraduate in 2004. So he was kind of finishing his MBA, also doing some, you know, popping in where he could. But really, there I was kind of focused on business development and proposals, bids. My father was more on the management on operations side. So that's kind of how we did it. So
what's the biggest successful proposal, if we may disclose?
Oh, the biggest successful proposal from back then or recent?
Not sure, honestly, but yeah, like,
well, I think I won't go to values or sizes, but I think what we did quite well is we were able to find some good projects. Our mandate that was Iraqis need to rebuild Iraq. And so what we tried to do is find opportunities where we could employ. I mean, one of the main issues, you know, in retrospect was the unemployment, the dismantling of the army. There was a lot of things that were, you know, we feel done poorly, mismanaged. And we felt that if you can just, you know, the needs, you know, the everyday needs are the same, whether you're in Iraq or US, wherever you are. And so we felt if we can put people to work, engage them, train them, develop them, you'd see, you know, not a growth on the micro scale, but on the macro as well. And that has a spillover, you know, economic development, you know, security issues. So one, you know, one of our
people do actual work instead of creating their own private.
Exactly. Just the alternative is very bad. You know, we don't want to, you know, go down that road. But like, so I think for us, we early days, what we want a project with some of the international companies here. They were doing water filtration, water systems, and we put to work, you know, maybe 125 people, local Iraqis, secondment, kind of doing staffing for them, making sure that they're, you know, we're doing paying Social Security, doing all the taxes, doing everything that needs to happen. So training and development and putting them to work. So I was quite proud of that. That was a project that I bid, you know, with a company called CH2M Hill. And then we were able to grow that business, which is still actually quite, you know, a decent size of our business today. So we, you know, we've probably employed over the last 20 years, you know, over 15, 20,000 Iraqis, you know, whether it be full-time or contract labor.
Yes, and we always ask this to our guests, sure. You know, local or foreign or people in the middle.
Yeah, I'm right? In the middle, right?
Yeah.
I'm a hybrid.
To a degree, right? Yeah, yeah. So how do you deal with Iraq? Or like, how do you deal with Iraqis, right? Yeah. I think in culture, in work, in their professional and personal lives, yeah. There's a... I don't want to say a structural or a radical, but a sizable difference, yeah. Right? In the way Iraqis think, work, and talk than people who've been exposed to other cultures. Like, yeah. Even me, I have difficulties, yeah. And even many of my friends. Yeah. So how do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, why are they radically different? Let's explore that just for a second. Sure. I'm curious to see why, because they are... We are a unique bunch, right? There is something. I think... Iraq has experienced a unique 40, 50 year span, right? Dating to, you know, the removal of the king into where we have modern day. So it's been a very tumultuous time. And I think those types of situations, those types of times, they can tend to harden people, right? And so Iraqis are tough. And that is wonderful, but sometimes in business that can be very challenging, especially when you're trying to manage a lot of tough personalities. So I think it's one of our greatest strengths and can be one of our greatest challenges. How do I deal with them? You know, I think...
And do you deal with them firsthand oftentimes, or is that not the case usually?
No, I deal with them firsthand on a daily basis. You know, we have today... I have my teams, but I also have, you know, I have leadership teams that know how to, that deal with. So we have about 650 employees in Iraq today, the Qadair Group. And we, you know, I probably within my group have 300, maybe half of them, 325. So, yeah, I mean, listen, as challenges as they are, again, I think their needs are just as the same as mine or anybody else sitting in America or Europe, right? So the first thing is I really try to connect with them on a personal level. I think the personal connection here is paramount, right? Because if you don't have that personal connection, it's very hard for me to get this person to do what I want, when I want, how I want, right? And I also need to you know, show them why... This is a lot of cultures, they don't ask why, they do. In our culture, there needs to be what are we working towards? What is this all about? Yeah. You know, why am I doing this this way? So I think it just takes a lot more effort and time. But I also think this is the advantage. Once they're bought in, they're bought in. You know, they really, once they believe in the mission and what we're working towards, and they believe that we have shared values, they're in. And so, I mean, I, you know, so numerous times it just takes a lot more effort, a lot more time to be able to say, explain that to them. And so what we've really done, you know, I think one thing that I'm really proud of our company about is we invest a lot in our people. In what sense do I mean? I mean, you know, just last year we did a leadership conference with our top 40 kind of leadership team, management team, and we connect, we talk about the latest business practices, but beyond that, we connect on a very personal level. And I think understanding and being real, being vulnerable, being able to speak to them on a, you know, one-on-one basis. I mean, listen, I'll be the first to tell you, we have within our group, within my father, brother, we have very different styles. And you've had good, fun conversations with my father. I have a very different style than my father, and that's okay. And by the way, it took me about a decade to really understand what my own, and I'm still learning it today, what my own true leadership style is, right? Because
I think about that. How is it different, right? Because we're always seeing, especially family businesses, yeah, right? The father has this strict approach, yeah, very straightforward, yeah, right? And the son is more like relaxed.
So exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that, and by the way, I'm still evolving. I think the first half of my career, you know, I'm roughly 20, 21 years, 22 years into this leadership journey, if you will. And I was sprung into it. I mean, I've got to say, I'm very fortunate to be in the position where we had the ability to start this based on, you know, having ties to the country, based on some assets, some relationships. So I'd say the first 10 years, it was a lot of mimicry, leadership by mimicry. This is what he's doing. This is what I need to do. This is what he's doing. This is what I need to do. It was great. Yeah, it was great. Got me through the first 10 years. I think after that, and this is when we established our presence in Dubai, where I was kind of there setting up that office, building up our leadership teams.
So why do you have an office in Dubai? I'm curious about that personally. Like, what's the reason?
Well, for us, we started out having kind of that support office in Amman, and you know, maybe 12, 13 years ago, we thought Dubai was a growing market where we can. It's really kind of the management office, so accounting, finance, engineering. We've got an engineering group that sits in Dubai. So whatever is not kind of on the ground, whether it be distribution, construction, project management, whatever that is done through our back office.
That makes sense because it's a more efficient market to a degree.
There's more experience there. There's more efficiency, you know, in terms of the resources there, whether it be, you know, the people, the banking, the, you know, the, it's all there.
Not everyone has that, by the way.
What's that?
Not everyone has that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, it's not everybody, but I think we've been fortunate. I think it's really, it's really professionalized our company in a lot of ways. Yeah. But back to your question in terms of differing styles. Listen, I think the reason for some of our success is those differing styles. I think if you had just a me, or just my father, my brother, who's very smart, very analytical, and brings a lot of just kind of tactical strategy to the table. I think our secret sauce has been the blend of all three. And so, you know, yes, my father is a little more old school. He'll tell you that. He likes to get involved in every detail. I like to delegate that to people that are better than me at that
point. My sense is that you deal better with the creative ones, right? You give them their space.
I like to let people do what they're hired to do. And by the way, most of the time, they're better than me at that role, right? So I don't want to take on a role that, you know, the logistics team can do better, the accounting team. So I'd like to give them room to grow. And so I really like to follow that delegated authority approach. But, you know, there's times where you got to roll your sleeves up and get pretty hands-on. And I think that's what I've learned from my father, that he does a really good job in. And he's also learning from us when to kind of just give people a little bit more room to do. So that blend, and it's a beautiful blend of kind of East meets West, to be quite honest with you. I think it's, and it's served us quite well. And we're always finding that nice, you know, equilibrium, homeostasis in terms of what that good balance is.
And you said very nice things about, like, you know, managing employees, even with different cultures, is that you have to get to know them on a personal scale, right? Which really matters, right? If Iraqis think of you as just someone who's interested in getting what they want out of them, which is the case, obviously, but in that way, they'll just dismissively, like, think of you as the boss. Right?
Our
boss wants this. I have no idea why.
Well, one thing that I tell my staff, and they've heard this from me often, is I genuinely and earnestly want them to leave our organization in a better professional, personal position than when they started with us. I truly believe that. And one of my most, you know, I enjoy our businesses. I got to say, I'm not necessarily always passionate about a specific project, but I'm really passionate about the people. And I take a great deal of pride around the people that we develop and grow. And we've had, again, thousands of people come and go. So for me, it's like, I want them to leave. I mean, hopefully they never leave, but most of the times they do, in a better position. And that's one of the things I take pride in as much as the dollar value of the project or completing a project. I like to see that. And that's something that I believe if you're genuine and earnest about that, people are really loyal and work really hard for you.
For sure. And so what do you mostly do now? Is it, let's say...
Good question. Yeah. Changes with the day. No, I'm kidding. We run four verticals. We have an energy solutions group. We have a machinery solutions group where we provide. So energy solutions, is basically we build utilities, pipelines. We do field services, everything downstream. On the machinery side, we run, we have rentals services. So anything from generators, cranes, man lifts. So we've spread that out now. We're operating those businesses in Europe as well as the Far East. So we've geographically expanded from Iraq to outside Iraq. We find we have certain assets that are maybe unutilized and we're able to machinery. Yeah, exactly. And so, or we have certain clients, international clients that are operating in the Far East or elsewhere. And so we've been able to grow that business more regionally.
So you give it to one of your clients that's in Iraq, but also has an operation in the Far East. How do you transfer a machinery? Is it quite?
Most of the time you can't. Most of the time it's just investment in new assets. So you're buying locally from that market. So it's based on the relationship with the customer.
So you're able to build a relationship so good with the client. Let's say it's a Chinese company that he tells you, come give me your machinery in China.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of their procurement folks are global, right? They'll be sitting in Houston and have a new project in Germany and wherever, right? And so we'll have an opportunity. So now you have to invest in some of these opportunities ahead of time. So there is some investment that goes into it.
How much of your business is that? Like, is it a considerable amount or does it come by every now and then, you know?
No, it's probably 10%, 15% of our business today is as outside of the region. It's been good. So, that we have a consumer goods division, which is fast moving consumer goods. So within that we're vertically integrated. We have bottling juice factories. We have licensing agreements with principal partners out of Denmark, a company called Coro. And then we also have the distribution of fast moving consumer goods.
How do you manage things? Let's say from abroad, right? Or when you're not in Iraq itself, yeah. Right? How do you make sure everything is going properly?
Yeah.
How do you get people you trust to report things to you correctly? Yeah. How does that work?
That's a challenge. That's a major challenge, and it's taken us a long time to set up that proper reporting structures and the leadership structure. So what we've done really is over the past, I'd say, in very intentionally over the past 5 to 7 years, create a strong leadership team. So now we have within our four verticals, we have two presidents and two vice presidents that report up to an executive that oversees it and the board. So we've just had to give more authority and autonomy to our local managers here and in Dubai that run any. So basically they're running a business within a business, right?
Yeah.
And so we give them the resources. So what I do a lot is I come and say, how's it going? What resources do you need? What support do you need? Where are your challenges? We decided on a strategic vision 6 months ago, a year ago. How is that going? Do we need to tweak it? Do we need to realign it? So those are the types of things for me on the executive side that I check in.
I think there's, as long as like there's no, it's more of just a trial and error thing, right?
Yeah. No big risk. Yeah. I mean, it's, well, you gotta allow them space to make mistakes.
For sure, but like no big risk as in no existential risk to the business,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. If it's
you know what I'm trying to refer to.
Yeah, exactly. As long as our people are safe and doing okay and this and that, so I mean, yeah, we're good. But there's always financial risks. But I think that the first and foremost, we want to make sure people are secure and safe and doing what they need to do.
No, yeah, for sure. So you've been able to kind of bring together a group of people who are stationed in Iraq, who you trust enough to report to you what's actually going on ground. And that's nice. So it doesn't really require you to always be here, like on site, which is a good thing, I
well,
think.
Well, my dad likes to be here on site all the time. Yeah. So, you know, I think he'd maybe say we do need to be here, but I think we've built it in a manner that it is quite sustainable. But you know, scalability requires our involvement. What else are we investing in? How do we grow it? And you know, we're starting some operations on the energy side in the GCC. So we're one of these unique companies that we've started here, and we're starting to expand outside Iraq, you know, from being homegrown here, right?
Yeah, and I think that's very unique. Actually, I don't know if many can't really name a single like group or holding company or company basically.
Oilserv is an oil field service company that started in Erbil. They're now in Basra, and they're a regional player now. They're all over. Yeah, they're very big.
Nice. But still unique, right?
Very unique, and
I think. And tell me if I'm wrong, but my perception is it's because you guys have been able to get educated abroad. You guys have been able to be stationed abroad long enough in a market that's efficient and competitive enough for you to be, let's say, qualified or equipped with enough skills and also credentials to do it in the GCC, right? I think the
fact that we're based abroad, and we're based in a place that allows us for regional and international expansion has really served us well.
Yeah, and everyone's at Houston, right?
Houston, you know, energy capital of the world, Dubai, you know, kind of the business capital of the Middle East, if you will. So those two locations have really served us well. You know, I don't know if it's the education abroad. I'm not sure if that's relevant or not, but I think, you know, being able to have a more of a global mindset, right? Has allowed us to grow and just seeing what else is happening out there.
You know, your dad didn't talk about that at all. He just kept talking about Iraq and Iraqi culture.
Well, I think we have different interests too. I mean, my father, you can sit with him and he'll talk to you hours because he and you'll see the passion that he has. I mean, for you know, having, you know, obviously studied abroad and lived abroad, I respect it. He has an opportunity at his age right now to sit and not do anything and relax. And he is actually probably one of the most active individuals in the entire organization because he loves it and he loves Iraq and he loves his country more than anything. And so, you know, he loves the game too, but he's also passionate about this country and he's seen what it has been in the past and what it can be again. So that's something that really is a motivation to him besides the financial or the growth of the business. So. I respect that.
In terms of your investments, are you thinking of going into Iraq more, or are you leaning into more the region, let's say?
So, I
also think it's a very unstable time right now for Iraq. So I think it's more of a sensible.
Why do you think it's an unstable time for Iraq?
I mean, not Iraq specifically, right? But everything going on around Iraq.
Globally, like, it's a bit.
Like, you're not seeing
tumultuous
billion-dollar projects entering Iraq right now.
Yeah. Well, I do think, you know, this is the byproduct of me not living here and not seeing you live it and see it on a daily basis, but you know, seeing the development in just in Baghdad alone, just coming back and seeing what's happening here, seeing the, you know, development all over in culture, arts, business, it's, you know, podcasts, this is you know, that are getting exported and consumed in the US. So we're enjoying that. I see a transformation. What I tell people a lot, you know, obviously people are always curious about Iraq and they want to know what's going on. You know, is it, what's going on? Is it, you know, so violence and this and that. And, you know, there's a lot of misperception. Now we have our challenges. Let me be clear. There's a lot of them. And you talk about them on this podcast very often. So I don't want to reiterate those. But what I will say is I do feel that Iraq is moving in the right direction. I feel that we have some fundamentals to build upon. Is it happening as quickly as I would like? No. But I do think that I'm very optimistic about the, you know, 5, 10, 20 year plan. And so if you have a long-term horizon, whether it be business-wise, investment-wise, I think it's a good bet. But why? Sorry, go ahead. No. But in terms of why invest in Iran? No, I'm a believer. You've seen what's happened in the investment, community, or within the venture space. When I say venture, I mean startups, tech-enabled businesses, a lot of which you've had here. The transformation over the past 7-8 years has been, really, really cool, very, very, interesting. I would have liked to have seen more regional international investors coming in. I would have liked to have seen more exits.
Is that not the case, by the way? Is it just them being afraid of rule of law, et cetera? Yeah. What's the concern there?
I think you got to look at it, the risk adjusted return, right? So the perception, whether real or overblown, is that Iraq is a very risky country. So for them, that, dollar in and $2 out, if they can do the same in the UAE or, Europe or US or other markets that are less risky, they're going to do that. So they're deprioritized Iraq. And also their investment horizon might be 3 to 5 years. It's not 5, 10, 20 years, as I'm talking about.
But isn't that reflected, let's say, in the cost of equity? If let's say, obviously, yeah.
It should be, but...
Our founders...
It should be, but it's not a perfect, it's not a very perfectly efficient market, right? Yeah. Especially on the venture, right? So the value you're buying in at, particularly at an early stage, whether it's seed investment, it's a lot of... estimation, guesstimation, call what you will, right? So yeah, there's some value to be had for investors, but you got to look at it also the market cap, in terms of what the opportunity upside is. If you're in the GCC, you're sharing, you've got X number of countries within Iraq. How many unicorns are we really going to have? So if I invest at a $10 million valuation and in a venture space, I really want to be doing a 5-10x, at least. Yeah. Am I going to exit at $100 million, that company? Is the founder going to? So we don't have any exits of the sort just yet.
There's very little, but there's very little, regulatory differences between the countries of the GCC. And even if they have each one individually has less population than Iraq, they also have as much, if not more, spending power than Iraq. So as you said, it's not a perfectly efficient market. So probably all the brains and the wallets, right, are heading there. And that's why Iraq is not kind of that
target. Not there yet. It's coming. I mean, you're seeing. I personally feel that the GCC is a bit saturated in terms of the venture space. There's still some good opportunities. So I started investment in the U.S., moved to investments in the UAE. 2017, I believe, was one of the first investors in e-commerce called Miswag, and just got the bug and
whose acquisition we've covered recently. I think 2 weeks ago we actually announced it on the event. Not sure if you.
I'm aware of it. Yeah, I'm very aware of it. So I'm no, unfortunately, no longer a shareholder, but I've got a lot of love and respect for Ammar, and he's a good friend of mine.
How did that process go? Can you just talk a bit about it, right? So how did the investment come about for Miswag, right? Yeah. And then we can talk about the exit, etc. Sure.
With Miswag, I found, we started, 2016, 15,
Can you just... Oh. We can, that's okay, anyway. But it's, sorry, yeah.
Miswag, yeah, good. Yeah. No worries. Yeah, so how did I get involved in the tech ecosystem here? And my involvement, especially with Miswag, was at 2015-16, as you recall, wasn't a great time in Iraq. Very kind of scary time. Daesh was here and there was a lot going on. And he had a lot of challenges in the market. And so
budget,
economically, yeah. Everything. And so there was just a lot of challenges. And so... I just had finished a stint at Singularity University in Palo Alto, focused more on, transformation, digital transformation, how do we techify things, kind of drinking the Kool-Aid, if you will, on that. So I come back, all wide-eyed and ready to go and just to see what we can do. I started reaching out to some figures within the kind of the tech ecosystem here. You know, there was Ficra Space, there was Byte Tech, there was a few people, you know, I reached out to them and just started connecting the dots and slowly you know, had an ambition to just learn more about what's going on there. There wasn't a lot going on at the time, but there were a few players, and I'd say Ahmad, and Miswag was probably one of the leading companies doing something. You know, he came from a background in tech. So I think I met him, and he was speaking at a conference, and then we sat down and we spoke, you know, maybe for an hour. I was very impressed with him, and we just kind of kept in touch. You know, I think he was a little like, who is this guy? What does he want from me? What's his angle? And you know, for me, it was just like, great. I just was really pleased to see that there was tech companies there, you know, and I'd done a few investments, small, you know, maybe 5 or 6 angel investments. So I'd had a little bit of experience, but not much. And, you know, after 2 or 3 months, it was like, you know, I want to invest in your company. And, you know, he was like, and I'm sure he was getting a lot of interest. I think he was at the time. And he was, you know, thanks, but no thanks. Thanks and no thanks. No. I think he was, but I think he didn't know who I was and this and that. So I think maybe after 6 months or so, we just kept on talking. And I think I showed him that I was genuinely interested. I had, you know, I wanted to help him. I wanted to support. I could maybe help him bring on additional capital, help him structure a cap table, help him, you know, with the term sheets and, you know, investment agreements and all that. And so, you know, big kudos to my wife, who also helped out because she's kind of the brains behind all the documentation and cap tables. Laura. Yeah. So she helped out with all that and eventually kind of let us in. And I think we were one of the first kind of structured investment was aware of where we came in and structured an investment. We're fortunately able to help them kind of help them on the fundraising side, help them kind of institutionalize a few things. Cause I mean, he had his hands full running this business. And so, you know, it was fun. You know, I wish we could have stayed on as an investor, but things happen you know, it was a fun ride.
From an investor's perspective, you know, so first of all, from our perspective, right? Community of people who are observing, right? Yeah. I think Miswag is a very, very inspiring story, right? Of a founder who went on to build this business when everyone thought it was not a very smart idea, right? To do e-commerce in Iraq. Sort of like Kareem and the other apps where we thought, okay, this works in the region, wouldn't. How's it going to go? Exactly. But he proved most people wrong, at least until, let's say, 2021, 2022, I think, we started to see actually this get traction, you know, and people started adopting it. And I started seeing my neighbors get a Miswag box while in the same delivery car is delivering it to me. And I'm like, wait, you also use this? Very unique moments, right? But obviously, I think the market wasn't kind to the business. Yeah. I think the situation overall wasn't kind to the business. Can we go deeper into that from your POV as an investor, right?
Yeah.
And how did that happen? You know, the timeline. Let's talk about it.
Well, I mean, you know, I given my role as a board member of Miswag, an investor, I'm not sure how much I can disclose, but I will say, I think e-commerce is a tough business. Okay. I mean, we saw that with Amazon, what, the 10 years until they hit a profit mark, right? So I think that was one. You just need a tremendous amount of capital to continue to run the business, burn the business, and get that volume growth. I think the adoption and transition to fintech and credit cards and all that delay and continuing on the COD, the cash, also was a challenge for him. And I think I think that if you had an earlier adoption, if this was a credit card based system and there was more fintech adoption back, you know, he's been around since 2015, 16, I'm not sure, it would have helped streamline the business. And I think you would have seen a lot more volume going on. I think because by nature of the fact that it's cash on delivery, a lot of people can reject orders, you know, deny orders and all that. So yeah. I think that had an impact financially on the business. And then I think the challenge was also, you know, COVID, post COVID, you saw a global slowdown in funding, right? You saw that it wasn't just in the region, but the region was impacted worse than most, right? So there was a lack of dry powder or willingness from investors to continue to invest. And I think that really impacted the business as well.
Right. And how did the lack of funding kind of contribute to the decision to go in another direction? Like, did you guys sit down, say, okay, since we can't get really any meaningful funding for this, we can't go it further at this point, right? We can't, we can't wait it out. And was it that sense? We don't have enough really capital to wait it out.
No, I mean, I think that was an Amar decision. You know, he kind of dictated where the company was going to go. And he felt that, you know, the acquisition by Keycard would be a strategic acquisition to help him grow and scale the business, right? So I think that was something that, and I do believe it was the right decision for him to be able to grow that. So he had options. There was, for a company like Meswag, there's always people that want to come in and want to invest. But I think it was the right decision. I think it's going to be able to give him that ability to hopefully scale the business.
And he had the majority of the shares at the time.
Okay. I'm not going to disclose cap table information, but yeah, he controls the business and still does. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. Nice. And then let's talk more about your fund.
Yeah.
And your al-mahfaza, as we call it. In Iraq. Some people,
which is our fourth vertical, which I didn't talk about with the investment side.
Okay. Yeah
exactly.
Let's talk more about that. So now it's called IVP, Iraq
yes.
Venture Partners,
yes,
correct?
Yeah.
Previously you had your own separate fund, like for the,
you do your homework, man. You're good. Yeah. We,
So you had Iraq Tech Ventures.
I had Iraq Tech Ventures.
What did you do there?
Iraq Tech Ventures was basically an angel syndicate, if you will, an Iraq focused angel syndicate. So when I say a syndicate, what I mean, we're syndicating funds. We're taking no fees. We're basically looking at investment opportunities. If I think it's viable, and if I'm not going to call anybody and ask them to join the round unless I'm writing a check myself. That's kind of the barometer that I've, I don't think it's fair to ask anybody to invest if I'm not going to be investing. Yeah, if I don't ask anybody, exactly. And so we did that. Laura, my wife and I started that 2018, I think, and maybe did two, three years of kind of syndication of deals, did about four or five investments, and then, you know, several follow on. And it was fun. It was good. I mean, it was early days.
What deals did you do? Did you do any deals at the time or was it?
We did. Yeah. So Meswag was one deal. We invested in a company called Al Sari. We invested in a company called, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. And then we invested in,
I think that's, either way, let's move on to IVP.
Right? Yeah.
So,
exactly.
So you went from that to a kind of a structure where you're collaborating or you're partnering with other people.
Yeah.
What initiated that move, or why did you even go from that?
For me, I think it was a matter of, listen, pooling resources, pooling knowledge. So we teamed up with an Iraq Venture Partners with Bassam Fadah of Innovest. He's very active in kind of the SME community here. He does investments. He does a lot of different programs and knows Iraq quite well, although he's originally from Lebanon. And then also joined up with the Hanlal Group, Omar Hanlal, obviously the station and Ashur Bank. They're very well established, early, developed pioneers within the ecosystem and helped the station with partners. So I felt the sum of us equal the individual sum of our parts, right? So I thought, I think it's the synergies there, if you will. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, we just said equal, so I said no, it's more.
Oh, more. Exactly. There we go. Thank you. Yeah.
Otherwise,
exactly. So you're right. So I felt there were some synergies between us there, and I thought that we could kind of come together and form which is one of the first real venture capital firms and funds within Iraq. There's obviously Euphrates out there doing some excellent work, and we felt there was EQIQ, exactly.
What was the size? What's the size right now of it? How much capital have you allocated to it? Is it disclosed?
It is right now. We have a $3.5 million micro fund that we're deploying. So we're not there yet. So basically it's seven individuals that have committed $500,000 ticket with the goal eventually of becoming a $25 million venture fund. Today, the deal flow is not exactly where we want it to be in terms of the quality and size of the deals. So I think that I think the ecosystem still has some development. That's where I said, you know, we haven't seen the growth, the trajectory, the kind of the way that we wanted to over the past 5 to 7 years. But again, I think in the long term, we believe that there's a lot of growth there.
For sure. So we don't see like deals being announced monthly by you guys, and that's okay. No one has that kind of pace. But let's take a look at it from like an observer point of view. So is there not the fact that there are not many deals being made right now? Is it the fault of I don't want to say fault, but does the blame or is the defect from the founder side where, let's say, I think there's a very, very reasonable argument to be made that we don't have enough competent or founders that are a good fit for your fund, right? We don't have lots of the right ideas, right? And the right ideas oftentimes don't need funding themselves. Yeah. Like they go and they bootstrap, right?
Sure.
Or can the argument be made that capital is not bold enough? It doesn't want to take enough risk in Iraq.
Good, which I'll come to in just 1 second. But I do want to hit on a few other things that we do with an IVP because our catalyst fund is quite small at the moment. So we're putting quite small tickets in early stage, kind of getting involved and, you know, trying to support.
You've already funded ORISD, I think.
ORISD. Yeah. We've done some follow-on funding on El Saria. We've invested in a company called Verity with an Iraqi founder, but he's based in the UAE. It's a fintech platform for basically educating for children. So you basically gives credit cards and a fintech kind of wallet, if you will, for so that can control spending, see spending for the kids. So. And then the last one where we're quite actively involved is Ordery with Shakir. I'm not sure if you've
which is like an international e-commerce kind of thing. It's competing with your platform.
Cross-border trading. Yeah, exactly. So he does, and he's adding on some of those different verticals.
Yeah. So two questions, if we might just take a pause on these ventures. So how does ORISD differ from Miswak in your experience? Both e-commerce platforms, both very similar. Right?
ORISD is very similar to Miswak. Yeah. So the investment on ORISD through IVP was after I had already divested my shares of Miswak. So
do you have a different scenario in mind for? Are you betting on that? Let's see.
I'm hopeful as the ecosystem develops that we can be, you know, we can see more growth and development. But I got to be honest, it's got the same challenges, right? So you need money, you got to keep fundraising. So
you're betting on the tailwinds, let's say.
Maybe some tailwinds. Maybe hopefully an acquisition of some kind. We'll see. But it's the challenges remain, to be quite honest with you. And I've seen a lot of challenges for a lot of these companies. Oh. The other company that I invested in Iraq, I gotta plug them if you don't mind, is IQ Cars. They're based in Erbil. They're really doing. He's doing a great job based there in Erbil. So I wanted to, I couldn't leave him off. So anyways, we were getting to, so just on the Iraq Venture Partners side.
So this is the first venture. Now, let's say Ordery.
Yeah.
So you're competing with both key-owned business anyways. What's your bet
there? What's that?
What's your bet there?
And what's my bet there? Well, I think Shakir's a brilliant founder. I think he's just got a great business mind. We are going up against some hefty competition. Let me say this about the competition side here in the ecosystem.
Stormboard people. So Ordery is competing with Pure Platform, which is also a cross-border kind of trading platform, which is in a partnership with Key.
Yeah.
And ORISD is competing with Miswak, which is owned by Key at this point. So both owned by a company
which is tough for me because I got a lot of space in my heart for Miswak. So you can see it on my face. So that's a tough one for me.
Company with huge funding, you know, has lots of synergies with fintech and loaning people, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you get these founders to compete?
Yeah. Well, let me talk talk about the competitive landscape, because that's a really good question. I actually I believe within this ecosystem, dissimilar to a lot of other industries, that we can have a lot of winners. All right, within the venture space, within the startup space. So I think we need to. What I like to try to do is promote the ecosystem at large. You know, so I don't believe it's a winner take all. I think we can have multiple winners in the space. So I think our challenge is attracting foreign capital. Our challenge is continuing to transition the way people buy, the way people live here, getting them more adapted and transitioned to tech enabled apps. And I think saying is it Ordery or Pure Platform, I think you can have both as winners.
I'm totally with you. But so, how do you get this actually to be at the same level, let's say, or compete, or say in Iraqi, say Ras Bras, right?
Yeah. You mean how do you get them up to that speed? Yeah. Well, we gotta provide unique offerings that maybe Pure Platform does not have. Certain things that the customers want, certain products. So we're looking at different verticals.
For example, Ordery, they have a gift section.
The gifting section.
I like that. Mm-hmm. Pure doesn't have that, for example. Yeah. So you're targeting something very specific. It's a gorilla approach kind of thing.
Yeah,
right?
It is. There is sometimes better, for lack of better, trial and error, right? Sometimes you're going to add some certain offerings. So eventually, you don't want to look identical to, Amazon. You're gonna lose, right? With Pure and Miss Wog having the support of Keycard, it's a very well-established, well-funded organization. We have to find ways to be more agile, unique, and provide other offerings. So if we go up head-to-head, it's going to be challenging for us. But I do believe that we have, some good entrepreneurs that know how to, execution. You can have funding. I think you'll agree that half the battle here is operations and execution. Iraq is a very difficult place to do business. So just getting that good delivered, getting that good in country, doing things the right way, compliant manner is critical for us to be able to properly execute and comply.
It's still nonetheless a risky bet. I think we have to admit that, right? And you've probably, it's not very hard through due diligence to find that out, that each of these has a conglomerate, let's say, backed competitor. Yeah. Also, is there another angle for this we can look at? For example, I saw your agreement with the IFC. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant, mm-hmm. right? I think these deals also pave the way for you to do more of these kinds of collaborations, sure. for these agreements, even in a PR kind of way. It's important, I feel, to a degree.
Yeah.
So how are you looking at that as well?
We have an agreement partnership with the IFC. We have a partnership with government, two different programs. One's called Scale Iraq. The other's called OSIF, Orange Corner Investment Fund. These programs are critical for us in that they do pave the way. They give us the ability to take on these projects as the ecosystem grows and develops. So yes, we have Catalyst, which is, some small investments, but it'll need to really help engage with startups, help give them some, some investment, some support, give them regional access and visibility as well.
Has the IFC allocated money to this?
They through the Scale Iraq program, but it's with certain requirements and limitations that we have to invest and support with key milestones and KPIs to make sure that we're supporting. At the end of the day, it's both of these programs are for us to support the companies within our program, right? The startups.
So what's the deal? Kind of is it? As much as you invest, we'll be with you guys.
Well, one of it is us investing in these companies, but the other is, getting them to regional conferences, giving them technical support, financial support, and due diligence. So really getting them so that they're investment ready, so that we can then take them on a roadshow and go try to attract a foreign investment. And it's been hard, to be honest with you, just because what we talked about in the outset, there's not, there. everybody's window shopping in Iraq right now with these startups. They're looking at it. Everybody has an interest, but in terms of the large regional investment firms, meaning the regional venture capital firms, not a lot of them have really entered Iraq in a big way.
Yeah, for sure. And we saw Asari do the collaboration with the Qatari business, right? Yeah. Which was very nice. Yeah. We covered it. We actually announced it on Tejab. Not sure if you able to see it.
I'm a fan. I watch. I'm glad.
Yeah. And we did an episode with Ustad Bassam. It was nice. It was very unique to see a regional business instead of saying, okay, as everyone has done, we'll enter Iraq with our own name and brand and everything. Yeah. Actually, we'll collaborate with this local business. It's a food delivery business, established, knows the market. Yeah. We'll give them money. We'll give them resources and let's go. Let's do it. Right? It really
was a great collaboration. And it was very smart. Bassam is very well-experienced business person, helped, you know, really structure the deal, engage with Snoonu. And I think they're finding the partnership's really taken off in a good way.
Yeah, that's awesome. So back to the IVP thing, right? The deal flow. So is it the founder's fault or is it the capital's?
I think attributing fault is maybe not the right way to do it.
Look, I like to stir drama.
I like it. I think it's more a byproduct of the infrastructure and where Iraq is today. Okay. I think there's quite a few factors that go into a successful tech ecosystem, right? Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley for a reason. You know, you got these universities all around. You got Berkeley, you got Stanford. You have an abundance of wealth and money and investment. You've got, very beneficial government support, you know, whether it be not direct government investment, but creating a platform regulatory environment that allows for people to take risks, right? There's no bankrupt. Nobody goes to jail if they're bankrupt there. So the whole ecosystem has allowed and thrived over the past, 40 years to allow us to be able to grow. So
in essence, great institutions are outputting great people, right? That's kind of.
Well, great institutions, but great, the environment. So institutions is one, right? You know, you need Stanford, but you've got a lot of great institutions globally. There's a reason you've got certain hubs globally that bring out certain, startup talent. But you need the investment side as well. That's a major issue. I think if you saw more investment coming in, you'd see a greater number of startups and a higher quality of startups, right? I do believe that it's a symbiotic relationship there. Now, can universities here do a better job? Yes, absolutely. They can and should. There needs to be entrepreneurial programs. They need to think in the modern economy sense, right?
I like what the AOIB is doing. If you're
following. Absolutely, AOIB. There's a few universities out here. AUIS, AUI. They're doing a lot of great work, right? Christine's got a whole entrepreneurship, she's been a guest out here and she's got a strong focus here. And Baghdad Business School. And so there's a lot that's being done, but it takes time, so I actually, when you say, is it the fault or whatever? And I know you're kind of saying it, kidding around, but I actually applaud a lot of these entrepreneurs. The environment and the challenges and the risks that they're taking on a daily basis. It's not easy. It's a very challenging environment. Doing this sitting in Palo Alto is challenging enough. Doing it in Dubai, probably other challenges, right? Doing it in Baghdad or Iraq or Bir al-Basra, this is phenomenal. So I think these are the pioneers. They're really setting the trend, and you're seeing the quality of the founders over the last 5 to 7 years is improving significantly. So, and you got the likes of the, Kareem coming in here and, Talabat and some of these big regional players. I think it's really helping. I think you're going to see an offshoot of people coming from those companies, seeing the best practices, seeing the way that those organizations are run and building their own startup. So I welcome it. I don't want them beating us in business, but I do welcome their involvement as it helps shapes the ecosystem and really gives us something to look at.
No, for sure. So I love this, the founder-friendly kind of talk. I totally agree. I have no issues at all. But so, yeah, I think if I processed what you're saying well, it's basically we have a lack in institutions that output individuals who are well-equipped to go on and found these businesses, yes. Right? And we have a lack of institutions that make investment or promote investment to a degree that becomes mainstream so that it becomes a culturally acceptable thing to do for them to start and put more effort into it. So, but
you... The lack of money.
The lack of money from...
Investors.
From investors. Yeah, I get what you're saying. But also, we have to think this way, right? I sometimes say, right, and I'm not the most experienced guy, right? I'm a teenager, but from the exposure I have, I don't really feel like there's a lack of money in general in Iraq.
Absolutely. Or a lack of government. There's no lack of funding. Yeah.
If you go and pitch someone really well on this idea that you have and you convince them that you actually need money to kickstart it, I think you'll find people. And if they're convinced in you as a person, right? Even regionally, right? I think if you had someone, let's say, who had a great alma mater, yeah. Great institutional experience, right? Everything. They can also accumulate some capital, right? Yeah. Someone would take a bet on it, you know, and say, let's tie, it's Iraq. But I agree in the sense that in terms of deal flow, there isn't much to go around in terms of companies, in terms of great companies and in terms of great founders from my exposure, right? And especially great founders who need capital, right? Because there are lots of great founders who bootstrap and that's the thing. But I think it's a difficult issue.
And You hit a good point on the funding or the money is out there. Like you can look around, Iraq has got, there's money here. I think
some legal
stuff. Yeah, exactly. But there's money out there, you know. So I think to your point, you're saying, listen, if it's a good investment, if it's a good deal, they're gonna get money. I gotta push back on that a little bit in that I think this asset class, if you will, or this investment class, if you will, on the venture side is, I mean, it's a fairly new one globally. When I say new 40, 50 years, right? It's 10, 15 years in Dubai. It's non-existent here, really. I mean, so well, you're starting to see some of the family groups like the Qadari Group and others, and the Hanlals and several others starting to say, hey, we want in on this. This is kind of a fun deal. Now, fun is not enough. You need to create returns, and that's what we have not been able. So you need to. Fun is one thing, but people want returns, and so at the end of the, that's where we're not there yet. I got to be honest. I'm not gonna paint this rosy, you know, color picture for everybody, because the reality is the ecosystem has a long way to go. But I think my point is, the investment allocation is not, I mean, everybody's looking at real estate and then they, you know, there's public equities, you know, Euphrates is doing and other. So nobody's really looking at this aspect. What I'm saying is just look at it. It's a growing sector. Don't put 40% of your, you know, portfolio in it. It's a high risk, as you said, asset class or investment class that we should look at because, you know, and I'm a financial returns investor, first and foremost. I also think this can be transformative for Iraq to move away from an oil-based economy to a human capital-focused economy. And I think that's really important for us to look at. You know, it's great to have this oil, and I run an energy company, and I'm very grateful for that. But I also think for us, we have to collectively, with support from the government, shift our focus and think about what are we going to look like? What's the economy going to look like in the next 10, 20 years?
For sure. So in an IBBC interview, the Iraq Petroleum Business Council, you said that, okay, I think it was 5 years ago. You said that oil is now at 60,
less,
65.
Less white hair is definitely less gray hair. Yeah.
But you said oil is at 60, 65.
Yeah.
What will Iraq do when it's at 30? Right. We have to think about that future. Yeah. I think oil is faring a bit better than that right now.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
Do we really have to fear much?
Well, you know, I think in the long term, yes. I mean, you're going to see. You know, let me step back. Iraq is going to be producing oil for a long time. Iraq's going to be one of the last places where oil will be produced and extracted because
that's actually what your father said. Yeah. He said Iraq will be the last place too.
I tend to agree with him. That covers how much, how many, what percent of the population does the energy industry employ currently in Iraq? Maybe 2-3%, 4%, 5, let's say 5. I'm not going to quote it because I don't know the actual figure, but I would venture to say it's less than 5, and it makes up 90% of the economy. That we need. What happens to the other employable market out there? So what I'm saying to you is, oil is great, but we need to diversify. Look what's happening in the GCC. Look what's happening in Saudi Arabia. They're creating a 10, 20, 30 year plan. We need to do the same. And I think I'm not saying tech is going to solve all of our problems. It's not, right? We're still going to have issues. We're going to have political issues, security issues, financial issues, but I think it's a good step. I think it can be a good equalizer for us to then start looking at things more broadly, train people up. There's AI coming on board. There's a lot that's coming, and we need to take steps to stay ahead of this, right? So rather than being, respectfully 10, 20 years behind the ball. And that's my whole point. Let's continue doing, let's do both, and let's do both very well.
Do you think it's realistic for us to do that? I mean, not in the sense of, is it possible? Obviously, I think it's possible, right? But
you think we're going to do it?
Yeah.
I agree. I think we can do it. I think that a lot needs to happen. And I think I'd like to see a large push from the government and the university. So really the government needs to set up an environment by which it helps promote and transition us from just oil to this. And you're seeing in the streets, I mean, it's amazing. Like, how many coffee shops can you put in on one street, right? Like let's invest in other things as well. I mean, they have the most beautiful restaurants and coffee shops, and there's money in the country. Let's start allocating it to the right things.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. What do you enjoy the most doing here when you're here?
Well, I'm quite busy when I'm here usually. I like to... My guilty pleasure is maybe kebab. No, I mean, I like just spending time, sitting out at, like last night, we were sitting out at the Babylon Hotel, nice weather, just seeing it. Just, I get very nostalgic. It really reminds me a lot of the old days in Iraq, especially now as you're seeing people walk around streets and things are kind of opening up. You feel the society's opening it up too. And it just reminds me a lot of, late 80s Iraq. So my guilty pleasure, I think, I shouldn't be doing it, just walking around the streets at night, sometimes by myself, just kind of seeing things and just seeing how vibrant, Iraqis are and how, Baghdad in particular. So I think just a nice walk around the neighborhood.
You work with the Iraqi Children Foundation,
yeah.
I think. What is that about? What do you guys do there?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, you really do your homework here. The Iraqi Children Foundation is a U.S. nonprofit organization, 501c3, that focuses on impoverished orphan children in Iraq. I think there's a lot of people, based in the U.S. that saw what happened 2003 and after and felt, there was a lot that was done wrong and that we needed to make some things right. And so it's an organization focused on supporting and developing local NGOs here. So we're not established and registered here. So we work with partner organizations, Justice Gate organization, IHOW, which is two really good organizations, one based in the north, one based here in Baghdad. And basically we have programs like the Hope Bus, based in Zafarania, where we set up buses. We've got, I think, the fourth one is just came online, and we provide medical services, educational services for a lot of the kids, frankly, that you and I know that aren't going to school. They're on the street. They're undocumented. Sometimes they don't have paperwork. So we do that. We help children with mental disabilities in Basra. We support some of the hospitals there. So we just find trusted partners, and it's something that I'm very passionate about. It's really near and dear to me and my family. We've been supporting it for nearly a dozen years now. I was proud to serve as the chairman of the group for, you know, some 4 or 5 years. And it's something that we'll continue to do.
You have children?
I do. I've got three. Okay. Three crazy little guys. Four, three, and one. So, so they're quite young. So that keeps me on my toes. So when I'm here on work, I sleep a little better than I do at home. But, very just fulfilling, right? You know, just kind of different perspective, pre-kids and post-kids.
You haven't set a career path for them yet.
Oh, no. I think they've got a little time on that. I think for me, I'd like them to pursue whatever passions and interests they want to pursue. I think my dad's already trying to recruit some of them into the family business. I'm like, Dad, they're a little young. You know, let's go easy.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Appreciate it. I love your podcast. We'll continue to watch it from all over, but especially in the USA.
I love your work. I love what you're doing. Love what the group is doing. Love what you're doing with the IVP and your efforts. And thank you to Mohammed for arranging this.
Keep it up. Thanks so much.
Cheers. Shukran.
Islam.
Okay.
Thanks.
What do you think?
That was great. Yeah. Oh, that was great. Good doing everything.
That was great, man. I should be
happy. You really do your homework. Jeez Louise. Laura, Yarov Marti, Yarov ICM, Yarov. That was great, man. Thank you very much. I thought it felt it was very natural, huh?
I did.
But you make it very natural, huh?
Yeah.
I think that's your secret sauce.
Maybe. I hope so.